Thank you, Chuck, for first of all the invitation, and secondly for that very warm introduction. Very happy to be here with all of you again. My topic, if you noticed, it's a little bit odd. I mean, in a way, what's more important than the meaning of life? But also, that's not something that we usually talk about in those terms, is it? Thinking of my own practice tradition, Zen. I went through the koan study and all these paradoxical koans, but none of them addresses, at least directly, this issue of the meaning of life. I wonder what one of the great old Chinese masters would have said if a student came up and asked them, "Oh, Roshi, what is the meaning of life? You better step back because I think you might get a slap or a poke in the ribs, or not. Maybe the master would just sort of drink tea, right? More, maybe that would work. Drink tea, sort of along the lines of, just this, right? You could say that the meaning of life is to live, isn't it? I mean, to be right here and now. The irony being, of course, that often, if not usually, we're not here and now, right? We're sort of off fantasizing about doing something else, being somewhere else. What did John Lennon say? Life is what happens while we're making other plans. And that kind of fits into this teaching about lack that I sometimes offer. Buddhism denies the existence, the reality of a distinct, separate sense of self. And in modern language, I think we could say that the usual sense of self we have is a construct, a psychological and social construct. And because it's a construct, it doesn't have any reality. And because of that, I think we often feel that in an indirect way. We feel our lack of reality as a sense of insufficiency, of not enough, of a sense of lack, right? The feeling that I'm not good enough as I am, that I need something more. In our culture, maybe money, fame, power, to be more successful in some way, or to become more beautiful, more sexy, more good looking, whatever. We easily get caught up in these, what I call lack projects. And the result of that is we tend to devalue the present when we don't feel that we're sufficient. We feel this sense of lack. We tend to devalue the present in terms of the future when we get what we think we need and then everything will be okay, right? So I can see that this question about the meaning of life, how we often aren't living here fully now. We're not just drinking that cup of tea, but we're so busy planning what we're going to do next in order to fill up this sense of lack that we're never, ever, ever here. So I think that's definitely a part of it. But I think there's also a lot more that needs to be said. Maybe especially to today, I think we tend to assume something that isn't necessarily true. And this is one of the things I want to emphasize, how we assume that the meaning of our lives, the broad general, where we're going, what we're doing, we assume that, well, that's a very individual self sort of thing. I decide for myself what the meaning of my life is. And in a way, one of the things I want to do is sort of kind of raise questions about that or put it in a spotlight. What does it really mean? I was raised as a Catholic, and I remember the Baltimore Catechism. The first thing that it said is, why did God make us? Well, to know, love, and serve Him. So there it's very clear. The meaning of my life isn't about what I make it. If If I don't want to get in trouble with God, I better do what God says, right? And obey his rules and all that. Otherwise, I get in a lot of trouble. And even in Buddhism, I think I recently came back from Southeast Asia, and for Buddhism too, if you think about lay people, what does it mean to be a Buddhist? Well, for a lot of them, they believe about karma, making merit. So for a lot of them, it would be very important as lay people to give things to the monks, food, money, its robes to the monks and to the into the temples and so forth. And even for the monks, actually, curiously, many of the monastics there, they have such an idea about how exalted and difficult enlightenment is. They think that, you know, it takes thousands of lifetimes of diligent practice in order to become enlightened. And often they're more preoccupied with sort of being what they call fields of merit, following all the rules so that when people give them things, they get lots of merit in return. Now, the reason I highlighted, again, the meaning of their lives, both for the monastics and the lay people, it's sort of in the religion. And I think it's important to see that is one of the main functions, if not the main function, of religion historically. It explains who we are, what's really important about the world, and how we should live. In other words, it tells us what the meaning of our lives should be. You could say the meaning is external. It's just out there, and it's our job, if we don't want to get in trouble, to sort of do what we're told. Otherwise, we're going to have problems one way or the other. But what I find really fascinating is when you look at it from this perspective, we can see that the meaning of life is actually just what Buddhism says. It changes. We can look at different stages in human history, and we can see how the meaning of life changes along with the fundamental Buddhist teaching about impermanence and insubstantiality, that ancient peoples had very different understandings, therefore, of the meaning of life than we do. And they certainly didn't understand it in the kind of subjective, I'm free to do whatever I want, right? So let me just spend a few minutes going through a little kind of potted history about how the meaning of life has been understood in different historical eras, going all the way back to the beginning, to hunting-gathering societies, right? Hunting-gathering societies tend to be very conservative. In a way, you could say they already live in the Garden of Eden. They're not trying to get anywhere else. They're not looking for salvation somewhere else. They're not trying to escape where they are. They often have animistic types of gods, but, you know, they're to help them, like to make sure that the animals they hunt will appear, or, you know, the berries, the fruit, etc., will be there. The important thing is, for them, the meaning of life is doing life. They're not actually trying to achieve something from it. There's never the sense that life is a means to something else. And that becomes very different when you come to the archaic civilizations of, I tend to think of Egypt, Mesopotamia, but you can also think of the New World civilizations, the Incas, the Aztecs, the Mayas. And there you get these very huge civilizations, lots of people. And once you get agriculture and you're settled in one place, you tend to get this stratified society where you have the king or the emperor, the pharaoh at the top, and the nobles and the warriors. There's more violent war now that there's more to fight about. And then you get all of the workers in the fields. Interestingly, in those societies, they don't distinguish secular from sacred. In other words, the king isn't just a secular ruler with power. He is also, if not a god, the high priest who communicates with the gods. The idea is that the meaning of life is to perpetuate this civilization, that human beings have a responsibility to keep the universe working. And we do this. We have a job. You human beings, we have a job. With sacrifices and other kinds of rituals and ceremonies, we actually have to keep the universe working. And if we don't do that, things will tend to fall apart. One very good example of that is the Aztecs, by the way. You're probably familiar with, I think we're all familiar with this very gruesome fact that they used to capture large numbers of people in the war, and they would sacrifice the captives, right? Drag them up to the top of their step pyramids and cut out their hearts with obsidian knives and offer them to the god of the sun or whatever. Why would they do that? They believed that their era was coming to an end, their third age, whatever, but that they could postpone the chaotic end by offering up all of these sacrifices. Again, it's a really good example of what's the meaning of life. We have to do these rituals. We have to do these sacrifices. We have to keep the gods, the great gods, happy, right? And then something very new happens. The Bronze Age societies, the Bronze Age civilizations like Egypt and Mesopotamia, around 1200 BCE, they collapse. And we can ignore the reason for the collapse, partly because no one's completely sure. Earthquakes, droughts, floods, etc. But out of that came a new kind of religion that included Buddhism and Christianity and the other Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Islam, and so forth. And these are called Axial Age religions because it's a pretty profound transformation. The other word for them, wait for it, is salvation religions. What they end up doing is they see that this is a world of suffering, right? And the idea is to qualify for something better. The idea of the Axial Age religions is not enough to sacrifice, it's not enough to believe. We actually have to transform ourselves. We have to live according to a certain ethical code and sort of believe in Jesus for Christianity. For Buddhism, it's a little different, of course. We need to meditate, practice, wake up, have this experience. But it's still the idea that this world in and of itself, as Buddhism says, this is samsara. This is the world of suffering. This is the place of craving and ill will and delusion and ignorance. And the idea is we want to escape. For Christianity, we can escape after we die. For Buddhism, we talk about rebirth as actually part of the problem, but even though it's not very clear what it really is, in early Buddhism, the idea is we want to escape, we want to transcend this world, we want to go to nirvana, this other place. So again, the world is salvation religions, which still predominate today. But something interesting happened along the way. You know, if you read about the early Christians, they think that Jesus was actually going to reappear in their own lifetime. He would return, the second coming of Jesus. They would all be, those who had died would be resurrected, and it would actually happen right here. But later, when that didn't happen, they talked about going to heaven. But over time, too, the belief in a kind of that kind of salvation in another reality, in another place in the modern world, I mean, a lot of us don't believe in that, do we? It's like it doesn't speak to us in the same way. But there has been a kind of secular reorientation, whereas the early Christians believed in escaping, transcending this world in a way after they die. There was a kind of secularization of the concept, and it became our belief in, guess what, progress. The idea that the world can get better, that the world is getting better, right? So it's not so much about escaping this world, except in the sense that escaping the now, because what we're doing is we're going to end up with a better world, right? Transformation from belief in apocalypse to kind of belief in this secular salvation, a kind of this worldly progress. The world is getting better and better, right? Economic growth, technology, democracy, women's rights, liberation, anti-slavery, right? The world is getting better and better, right? Well, one of the interesting things that's happened over my lifetime, I don't think we believe in progress in quite the same way, certainly not young people today, right? Because we can see what's happening. I mean, we can see ourselves that the world is in a very difficult place. It's not only that we don't maybe believe in another reality, a higher reality, but we can see how basically we're messing up this one. I'm sure I'm not saying anything new, but for anyone who's paying attention, we have to acknowledge we're in a very dangerous situation right now. A few years ago, Noam Chomsky said it's the most dangerous time in human history. And I think he's right, right? He talked about climate change. He talked about the danger of nuclear war. He talked about the decline of democracy. And all of those have actually become much worse since he said it, I think, in the September of 2020, right? He said that before January 6, before Trump's re-election, before Russia invaded Ukraine and so forth. In many ways, I think things have gotten worse. So if it's the most dangerous time, certainly that seems to be the case. So what does that mean? It does seem to me that we have finally become globalized, but our now global civilization seems to be self-destructing. It's lost its way. And here I want to pause a bit and just ask you to reflect on that. What does that mean? Whether or not you agree with me, and I think maybe many of you do, how does it make you feel? How do you react? Knowing the situation we're at today, does it make you feel sad? Depressed? Despairing? Excited? Please understand, I haven't abandoned this question, what's the meaning of life? But this is a way to circle back to that, right? If you're like me, I think you feel more than one thing at the same time. And I have to say, for me, I feel this urge both for fight and flight, in the sense that, I've lived maybe the majority of my adult life overseas. And in many ways, American culture doesn't really speak to me. I'm very happy overseas. My wife is British. So part of me would love to go somewhere where these problems don't exist. And of course, there's no such thing. At the same time, too, I also feel there's a sense that the United States is kind of the belly of the beast, just like it was back in the 70s when we were draft resisters, that this is where the work needs to be done, right? So I guess what I'm saying is I feel more than one thing. I feel a number of things. And it reminds me of something in the Tolkien's novel, The Lord of the Rings, which I think many of you are probably familiar with. There's a lovely scene in the middle where Frodo is talking with Gandalf, the wizard, right? And Frodo, they're talking about what they need to do. And Frodo says, quote, "I wish it need not have happened in my time," said Frodo. "So do I," said Gandalf, "and so do all who live to see such times. But that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us," right? So we may not like it, but this is the situation we're faced with. And then Joanna Macy comes along and says almost the opposite. I feel so fortunate to be alive now. People might think I'm crazy, but just speaking personally, it's an incredible thing to be alive with my fellow humans at a time when the future looks so bleak. Right now, we can be here to honor life. It's a precious thing. Can we be grateful for this opportunity? Kind of interesting. Which of those is true? Which of those is your feeling? Which of those is your perspective and attitude? Can they both be true? Because it's hard to believe in progress now and facing the very dangerous situation we're in, I think when you let go of a belief in progress, it's very easy to fall into a kind of, nihilism? A kind of individualism that's totally indifferent to what's going on? Addiction, deaths of despair that we hear about, existential questions of, I think for many people, the religion of consumerism, a false religion that doesn't really make us happy, right? What did Ivan Illich say? In a consumer society, there are two types of slaves. There's the slave of addiction and the slave of craving, right? The slave of those who have the money to buy all those things were advertised, and the slaves of those who see the same images, the same advertising, but don't have the opportunity. Another way to kind of sum up what I'm trying to say here about this history is that, remember, when you go back to those great agrarian empires, we had a role to play, right? Even for the Catholicism that I was raised in, a role to play, right? We had a job. But you could say loss of belief in that kind of higher reality or spirituality means that in the modern, postmodern world, we have no role, we have no function. We're just here. All we can do is what? I guess, enjoy ourselves if we can, while we can, as long as we can, right? And I think, frankly, that's a pretty accurate depiction of the way an awful lot of people feel. But what I'd like to do, moving toward a conclusion now, is suggest that that's really not necessarily the end of the story. That from a Buddhist perspective, we can perceive our situation quite differently, such that meaning is not neither objective external, but also not merely subjective. Because remember, Buddhism denies anatta, right? There's this anatta teaching, no self. The presumption of the kind of individualistic subjectivity is that, I have my own separate life. But what if, as Buddhism says, that's not the case, right? What if the sense of separation is a delusion that we can see through in our Buddhist practice, right? I remember my teacher, Yamada Roshi, saying that when people have kensho, this glimpse, this first taste of enlightenment, along with that, there's the natural, spontaneous welling up of compassion. And it seems to me that as we practice and as we begin to see through the delusion of separate self, it very naturally leads to the bodhisattva path, right? It's something that evolves sort of quite naturally. And goodness knows we need people following the bodhisattva path right now. All of that, everything I've said this evening leads up to this quotation that I now want to share with you, which in fact is the whole reason for sort of writing, structuring, offering this talk. It's by someone called Tom Rivett Carnac, who was actually one of the authors. He was a major figure at the 2015 Paris Climate Talks, okay? And I think he really nails something here that we need to think about very seriously. This is what he says, anyway. You have the biggest opportunity in all of human history to live an incredibly meaningful life. The actions that you take because of the accident of the time of your birth, in other words, just by accident, we are born. We are living at this incredibly dangerous, incredibly important, pivotal time, right? He says, the actions that you take are of an order of magnitude in importance. Fancy way of saying, like 10 times as important compared to most people who have ever lived before. Because you are going to affect the future of life on Earth in 50, 500, and 500,000 years by what you do in the next couple of decades. So, no one is asking for an easy life. Really, deep down, what we're asking for is a meaningful life. Remember, the meaning of life, it's contingent, it's impermanent, it changes because we're not really separate from the world we're in. We're an embodiment, we're an expression of it. Well, what's this world that we're in? It's incredibly dangerous. It's at a turning point. What does that mean for the meaning of my life? What does that mean for the meaning of your life, right? I'm reminded of a couple Zen stories. A student asked the master, "What should we do when difficult times come?" The master said, "Welcome them, embrace them. Our path isn't about avoiding difficulties." A student of Master Ryokan asked him, "Is there any way to avoid calamities?" And Ryokan replied, "When you are met with a calamity, meet it completely. That is the wondrous dharma of avoiding calamities, right? Become one with the calamity, become one with the challenge." I love it, right? And as we know, these are often the times when we are challenged, we grow, we are changed the most. A third and final Zen story, a student asked Master Unmon, or Yunmen in Chinese, right? "What is the fruit of a lifetime of practice?" He replied, "Responding appropriately." I love it, I love it, I love it. It's not about qualifying for some other reality, or it's through our practice, what we are really training, what we are learning to do is responding appropriately to any situation that we find ourselves in. And of course, the big challenge is how do we respond appropriately to what may well be the most dangerous time in human history, right? When we see through this duality that our practice encourages us to do, see through the duality of separation, that I'm in here and all of you are out there, and this sense of separation, in a way, it's wonderful because we return to this question. So much of the problem in modern world is that we no longer believe we have a role to play. We have no function. It's not like those archaic agrarian cultures where humans had to keep the cosmos working. Well, guess what? Actually, we do have a role to play. We are called at this most dangerous time to do the very best we can. And that's amazing. I mean, I'm just amazed by that. Yeah. What form that our bodhisattva activity will take? Well, I think that's going to vary. The traditional teachings, they're all pre-modern. They don't give us specific answers to the situation we find ourselves in now. But the basic attitude is, I think, really important. And I'd like to finish by mentioning these three questions that I like to offer. Buddhism can't tell us what to do. It can tell us a lot about how to do what we do. But I think we can, through our practice, decide for ourselves what's appropriate for us. And I like to highlight these three questions or contemplations or meditations, if you will, that can help us decide. Number one, what do I have to offer? Taking into account everything about my situation, right? My age, my health, my training, my skills, my networks. Am I retired? Do I need to work, make money? Taking into account all of that, what are the good possibilities for me? And number two, well, that is the second one, sorry. What are the good possibilities for me given what I have to offer? And of course, there are so many things that need to be done, but we'll just burn ourselves out if we try to do everything. What should we focus on? And finally, this third question, given the possibilities, what calls to my heart? What speaks to me? What's pulling me? And this is more than ego. It's this is through our practice. I think we can open up in a way that we can sense what we're drawn to, where we might make a difference, where we are most likely to have the most energy. So I would like to end by encouraging all of us to sort of reflect on those three questions. And finally, I recently came across a quotation from Mark Twain, which I think is a nice way to end. He said, "The most important days in your life are the day you are born and the day you find out why." May we all find out why. Thank you.
Thanks, David. That was wonderful. So I've got a whole page of notes here I'm gonna be looking over, but I was gonna open the floor here. So anyone who would like to comment, feel free to unmute. I encourage you to turn your cameras on if that feels comfortable. And yeah, lots to consider and contemplate here.
I hope what I said made some sense, but sorry, go ahead, Doug. Yeah.
Good to see you. I think you're familiar with the writer Arthur Brooks, I think his name is.
Yeah.
He writes in The Atlantic. His favorite topic is happiness. And among the number of things he said that I've remembered, he makes a clear distinction in terms of actually the causes of happiness, as being focused on extrinsic versus intrinsic rewards. And I think quickly we can list the extrinsic ones. You're quick to do that: money, fame, celebrity, or prestige, all that stuff. I'm just wondering, in your experience, your decades as a teacher, what do you have you seen catalysts, or what helps someone to shift from an extrinsic orientation to a more intrinsic, in terms of intrinsic, so doing something because it's right, it's true to yourself? Is
Right.
it an experience of dukkha? Is it, I don't know if you have any thought that comes to mind about what can help people shift, because we have a culture that's entirely geared towards the extrinsic.
Yeah. Great question. And one answer, may be the only answer that I can offer. Well, let me say it this way. I think sometimes in our lives, things fall apart, and we do get a sense that, those old extrinsic values just aren't working. And so we're at that point looking for something more. But, speaking most personally and remembering my own career, I know my own life changed dramatically when I met my teacher, Yamada Roshi, right? It was very strange, right? Somehow I had inveigled myself into a sesshin in Honolulu. I didn't even know what a sesshin was, okay? And maybe I was just primed to respond in this way, but you know, when this guy walked into the room, it was just sort of like, whoa. It's like he was manifesting something, and I don't even know how to describe it, but there was something about his character, even something about the way that he moved, which just touched me deeply. And I remember thinking or feeling, it wasn't just thinking, feeling, if Zen practice can help me be like this guy, that's what's in it for me, you know. So I think for many of us, when we meet somebody who embodies these intrinsic values and who's not preoccupied with money, fame, trying to impress us, that shows us an alternative. It's concrete. It's not just something we read or an idea, but it's actually there in the flesh. And for me, at least, that was really, really a turning point. I don't know. I expect others can offer maybe similar or other answers, because I think that's a really, really important question. I think it also matters, like if we're at the point, it's like Yamada Roshi could walk into a room, and for most people, so what? But so it was something about the place that I was in that I was ready for that. So you could ask, what is it that made me ready? What is it that makes any of us ready? That's really important. Thank you for that question.
Dahlia?
Hi, David. Hi, Sangha. So I was just kind of trying to thread all of this together, and I keep coming back to what looks to me to be the core issue, which is impermanence, right, of our relative selves. I mean, what and regardless of what time period we're even looking at, you know, whether we're part of a civilization that's sacrificing to try to appease, you know, the gods, or whether, you know, we're someone who's turning to a dictator who's creating external enemies and telling us what to do and how to think, or creating enemies within. I mean, you know, it's all distraction. It's all distraction from this insecurity, this basic insecurity we have as just, you know, insecure human beings on this planet. And I think really coming face to face with this lack of control that we have, especially in the US, you know, we not only have, I mean, we can control, like, we have our own personal waterfall in our homes, right? We can control the temperature. We can, I mean, and as well as trying to control other countries. So I think we have such a control complex, maybe more so than a lot of other places on the planet, you know. But what I'm wondering about is, you know, this idea that having an experience of the absolute, because you know we have those two planes of existence. I don't know how to reference that, but the relative and the absolute, that once you begin having more of those experiences of connection that we all already have, we just are distracted by all of this other stuff and the insecurity that we live with, that I wonder, would having more connection with this absolute lessen this grasping for security in the relative world, and then allow us to do what you were saying with those three questions, like go out into the world, but from a really different place, like not trying to earn points for heaven, right? Or prove that I'm a lovable, worthwhile human being, but just because we're channeling that power of that absolute, and that brings the peace. I don't know, those are my thoughts. What are your thoughts on that, David?
You know, it's interesting. I've been writing a lot lately, working a lot on this whole question of absolute and relative, and And this is definitely relevant to what we were saying, because I think it's so important for us to realize that, you know, what we might call the absolute is not some other reality, some other place, but the true nature of this place, that we're not trying to go somewhere else, which makes this place into a means, just a theater where we qualify for somewhere better. But it's really about letting go of ourselves, realizing the true nature of here and now. And that also opens us up to this question about answering the meaning of my life. I mean, one way to try to summarize what I try to say is the meaning of my life, that's not something objective or external, like the religions give it to me, but neither is it subjective in the sense of, you know, I'll just decide. I mean, for Buddhism, there would be a kind of delusive quality. Rather, it's connecting, as you say, with this absolute, or as I prefer to say, realizing the non-dual, our non-separation, and out of that sense of connection and being a manifestation, each of us, everything being an impermanent, insubstantial manifestation, then out of that, there will arise this sense of how we can engage. Because the old things about ego, it's like, what's in it for me? What's going to make me money or famous, or, you know, that whole project, that really falls apart, collapses when we realize there's no separate self. And then this bodhisattva thing comes to the fore of, hey, yeah, I'm not separate from all of you. I'm not separate from all the thing. Hey, what can I do to make this a better world for all of us? And depending on who I am, where I am, you know, it's going to be different, but it's out of this this non-dual interactive thing that I think the question of meaning comes. And as I also tried to say, it's especially important now, given the incredibly dangerous time we're in. And we don't even have to talk about Trump. You know, I probably shouldn't even mention his name, but, you know, we can all realize what's going on. Yeah.
Yeah. I was gonna
Thank
say
you,
it's not
Donna.
Voldemort. You can say his name.
You know, I do sometimes call him he who must not be named, but it's hard to have a conversation lately where he doesn't come up in one fashion or another. Yeah.
So I had a question that the very question of the meaning of life, when one approaches that absolute, what would, I wouldn't even call it an understanding, but something like that, perspective maybe, that the actual question of a meaning of life dissolves pretty much like everything else, so that it doesn't become, because in some ways the pursuit that you're talking about, the ends to the goal, could also be applied to this question of the meaning of life. And so I think that my sense is that as one as one advances down the path, there's a certain point in when that questions like that just they simply dissolve. That they're it's not a, you know, it's ephemeral or
Yeah, Chuck, I think that's exactly right. And they dissolve because in a way they're answered. I mean, to me, the whole idea of the Bodhisattva path, right? It's not, you know, it's not, it's something that happens organically, spontaneously. It's just like, you know, the usual sort of self-preoccupation, like as I said, what's in it for me? It's like that loses. That just reinforces the delusion. It sort of loses its power. And what we naturally, spontaneously find ourselves doing is sort of asking, okay, where might I make a difference? What might I do? And so in a way, I think you're right. The question doesn't arrive The question doesn't arise or persist in that form. It just means we find ourselves living in a certain kind of way, which is less self-centered, more compassionate. And it just sort of seems quite natural. It's not a sacrifice. You know, sometimes if you read in the old Mahayana literature, the Bodhisattva is sacrificing his or her own enlightenment for the time being to help. No, it's not a sac, you know, it's just kind of naturally, I think, what we want to do with our lives. And I think that to me has always been one of the most wonderful things about the Buddhist path, which is one way of expressing the path. Yeah.
Looks like Lewis, did you want to say something?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yep. Go for it.
Great. Hi, David. Thanks for the great talk here. Yeah, just compelled to share here just a naughty, well-articulated reflection or questions, but just sort of impressionistically some of the things that arose for me in response to your talk. Something that came up I haven't really considered before, if you think about in the context of, you know, the countless world systems that have arisen and disintegrated, how typical this pattern must be, basically, that, you know, the situation that we find ourselves in now, where, not to get into othering, but to make the distinction that's made in the Dhamma, you know, between uninstructed worldlings and the noble disciples, and how typical a pattern it seems that it must be for uninstructed worldlings, in large part, to basically bring a species or a world, you know, to an existential brink. And so, in that sense, kind of reflecting on that in that way sort of makes me feel not in a way that sort of downplays it trivializes it, you know, the urgency, but sort of leads my heart to consider all of it, or to include all of that also in the sort of dreamlike nature, you know, the dream metaphor that the Buddha evokes, you know, and to hold all of that in that context as well. So not in a way that you know, leads to indifference or nihilism, but instead a sort of a call to practice, you know, to cultivate the perfections, for example, or just other aspects of the Dhamma, you know, to respond to all of this sort of fleeting phenomena, you know, with wisdom, compassion, and intentional living, you know, the ways that we're all called to practice. So, yeah, very, very rich talk. Thanks very much.
You know, when I talk about the Bodhisattva path, the first thing that I almost always say is that it has two sides. Bodhisattvas continue to work on their own. They still have their own meditation practice or whatever that may be, working on their own transformation, you know, their own development, spiritual development, if you will, but they know that's not sufficient. But so it's not as though they're sacrificing the one for the other. I think that the two, the kind of personal transformation and working for social transformation, that these two really, really work very well together, so much so that they really need together. Because if we don't continue to meditate and work on our own equanimity, emptiness, serenity, you know, how easy it is to get burned out and this kind of social ecological engagement. So it's important to keep that grounding, I think, and not to sort of simply sort of get some idea of going out there and try to make things better. And, you know, depending on how deluded we are, we might just make things worse. But if we can cultivate the two sides and remember that, I think that can make a huge difference. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for your comment.
Any other last final questions? Otherwise, we should, just in the spirit of being timely, we should kind of wrap up. So let me just do a quick dedication of merit, and then we'll have our usual goodbye session. So we can just all take a couple moments to just arrive back here all together. And let me just say that I wish that we can share the benefits of this talk and our time together with all beings everywhere. And may all beings everywhere be motivated by kindness, generosity, and wisdom. May it be so.
May it be so.
And now's the David Chernikoff moment of free for all. Everybody can jump on, say hi, good night, whatever you want to, and then we'll bring it to a close.
Wait to see a lot of familiar faces and a few new ones. Yeah.
Great to have you back, David.
Thank you.
You.
Tim, I was going to ask you, what's that mountain behind you? That's cool.
That's the 10-mile range at Breckenridge.
Oh, nice. Nice. Okay. Just curious. All right.
By the way, David, I wanted to say for fun, the reason I don't have my camera right now, my wife stole it. She teaches Japanese at CU Boulder, which I thought you might find to be a fun fact.
Wow. Nihonjin.
Yeah, so she's doing that right now, so she has my camera. But good to see everyone. Much metta.
Be well, everyone.
Yes, thank you very much. It's nice to have you back.
Thank you.
You kind of twisted, put my brain in a knot, but maybe that's a good thing. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for coming, and may we meet again. May our paths intersect again in the not too distant future. Thank you again, Chuck, for the invitation.
Of course. Thanks so much for speaking. All right. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Thank you all.